Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast contains explicit language.
And boom, the editor will magically take us somewhere else.
Also, the editor will go back and fix that.
No, I think we live in the real, man. I think we live in the real.
We'll be right back.
We're somewhere right now. We are floating in space.
I don't know about that.
The editor needs to help us. Bring us back, editor. So that happened. This week, the shocking murder of two television journalists in Virginia forced us to confront once again the fact that the only thing America seems to be good at producing anymore are mass shooting tragedies. We're joined by Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy to find out if we finally reached the point where we might courageously attempt to solve this problem. Meanwhile, reality television mogul Donald Trump seems to be doing everything he can to alienate every last Latino voter in the country. But will his flamboyant hostility accrue to other members of his own party or the eventual Republican nominee? Joining us to answer this question is NPR's Latino USA digital media director, Julio Ricardo Varela. Finally, as Joe Biden mulls getting into the 2016 race, he's taking meetings with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. But we're going to take a trip back to 2005 and take a look at an early meeting between Biden and Warren where they fought over a bankruptcy bill that would change the game for Main Street. Plus, we're going to talk about this week's crazy stock market susurrations and the battle to defend ancient culture from ISIS. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Akbar Ahmed, Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Elise Foley, and Allie Watkins. And here's what happened first. Hey, everybody. Welcome to So That Happened. We have a really, I would say, exquisite show today, a show that will help us get through what was kind of a rough news week. Joining me, as always, well, not as always, but most of the time.
I'm here. I'm Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter for the Huffington Post.
And I'm Arthur Delaney. I have a less pretentious title.
Yep.
And you're a less pretentious person.
I'm Jason Linkins. I live in the clouds. So, how's everyone doing this week?
Oh, the stock market on Monday.
Any good stuff this week? Any good things to report? Just like, even if it's just like you took your dog for a walk and it was nice.
Certainly not. Let's get straight into the crap.
Yeah. It was a dog shit week. Let's talk about it.
It was kind of a dog shit week. I will say, I saw a show this weekend. My friend Adrian came to town with a show called One in the Chamber. It was a very humane look at guns, the people who own guns, the people who are affected by gun tragedies. Very humane, so well done, so well acted. And I was like kind of riding a high of like getting to this like kind of humane place, a well done drama about this issue that I felt treated people decently, had decent things to say. And then this week, it like the most recent mass shooting just kind of like ripped open the wound all over again. It was weird going from the feeling where like a piece of theater can do what a theater does and knit up your soul. And then, like, the world comes and says, fuck you, I'm ripping that bandage back off.
Reality is worse than art, it turns out.
Yeah, it was terrible. Sucks. It was terrible. I'm gonna talk to her to see what it's like to do that show in a week where there's been, like, a real, like, news-grabbing gun tragedy.
But, you know, other things that aren't real make people feel good and bad in different ways. And one of those things is the stock market.
Which was, like, at the beginning of the week, it was, like, everyone was like orgasming over what the stock market was.
It was Armageddon. Everyone was tearing their hair out with orgasm.
Right. No.
It was treated with significance because we have this phony, baloney thing where we all pretend that it's some kind of proxy for American well-being, which it is not.
No, it was like, okay, arrow no point at sunshine, arrow point at ground, must worry. I was like struck by the fact that like the susurrations of the stock market are exactly, it must have been what it was like back when mankind was first gaining sentience And like every time the sun went down, it was like, what the fuck? Is it over? Is it all over? Let's huddle. Are you still warm? It's all over, man. It's all over. And then the sun comes back up and is like, we're spared. Everything is great again.
Sacrifice a goat.
The world is perfect. And then the sun goes down again. It's like, what's going on?
Sacrifice another goat.
Yeah, it was crazy.
I mean, what's interesting with the stock market stuff, though, is that people do have these same reactions. Like, oh, my God, something terrible is happening to the American economy. Like Arthur, you were saying, the stock market's been pretty divorced from what's going on with ordinary people's lives for a long time. It's been way up, and the economy has been pretty shitty since 2008 through 2009. Yeah. The stock market's just gone up and up and up.
It's right. Irrelevant. Yeah. It matters if you're about to retire and you're looking at your portfolio, but in the long run, if you have, even if you're a regular person who has stock, the daily ups and downs
are just not important.
They don't
it's
matter.
A good question: What is a normal person really supposed to do the day the stock market's having a mild sell-off as Monday was?
It's capital worship. There's this unhealthy obsession with shareholder value, which is actually, you know, shareholders for the most part are wealthy people. It's not right. Main Street America. It's Wall Street,
yeah.
Obviously. But I think it's treated by the news collectively like something that's more significant to the, like, psyche of the American people than it really is.
Yeah, there was a really good report in the Washington Post a couple of years ago, which was looking at who makes capital gains. You know, capital gains is the profit you get from either owning stocks or bonds, and also real estate, but, you know, fancy rich people assets. 50% of those gains don't go to the 1%. They go to the top 0.1%. So we're really talking about, I mean, I think only a third of all people in the United States even have a 401k account where they would have stock. So it's a thing that matters to rich people. And over time, those people are going to get richer because, you know, Thomas Piketty has shown in his book that if you just stay in the stock market long enough, your capital is going to grow faster than the wages of everybody else.
Right. So. I keep saying when everyone's panicking, I was like, wait, aren't you guys all conservatively invested in index funds? Then what are you worried about? Don't worry about it. Just shut up and chill. Shut up and chill. You're fine.
And so this
think about the people who can't be conservatively invested in index funds. There are a lot of them. They're the ones that like live on the needle's edge every day. But you're fine.
And what we're saying would apply to, you know, several weeks worth of bad stock market. But this was something that happened for half a day.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was a story all week.
And the big story is that the global economy really is kind of unstable. The American economy isn't great. The recovery has been pretty weak and sluggish. And a lot of the areas where the recovery looks good are these sort of paper arenas like the stock market. Well, oh, we've got all this magic capital that came in since 2009. That means things are good. But wages are still kind of crappy. Unemployment rate's still higher than it needs to be. And China's economy, I mean, which I think is the immediate cause, to the extent that we can diagnose a cause for all the volatility, you know, China's economy is kind of built on, you know, dreams and unicorns too. And when people realize that there are dreams and unicorns underneath all of this stuff, they're like, oh, crap. What am I going
to
do?
It's really hard to actually explain just how ephemeral, like when you get into the stock market talking about it, how like you're really just talking about a collective unconscious attitude toward an ephemeral concept of money. Like if you could imagine like waking up tomorrow with the just like weird feeling that guacamole sucked and like everyone in your neighborhood in your state woke up tomorrow and was like, guacamole is bad for you. Like what it would do to the world just to have that little susurration. It would be like a real thing that would happen, but it's also for like no fucking reason. Like everyone woke up and decided X was the case. It's crazy.
Yeah, and it's your attitude about guacamole and also what you imagine other people think about guacamole. It's a psychodrama.
It is, basically.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
All right, welcome back. And joining us now, we have Senator Chris Murphy. Senator, thank you for joining us today. And I wish that I had, you know, obviously a happier occasion to bring you on the podcast. But obviously, we had a quite rancid story in the news yesterday. gunman, another mass shooting. This time it had some seriously gross overtones. Gunman filmed himself and put it out on social media. I think it was one of the more disturbing events I've ever lived through vicariously. Washington Post has put out an article yesterday that there have been 247 mass shooting incidents in the United States this year, which is kind of remarkable because there have only been 238 days this year. So with every sunrise, we get a mass shooting. How do you react to this at this point?
So, I mean, I really believe that Congress's silence in the face of this rash of mass shootings has become complicity. I really do believe that people take cues from the highest levels of government, the highest levels of public service, and we are essentially sending a message of quiet endorsement of these murders. And it's not just the mass murders, because those have gotten the news stories, but this has been another terrible summer in places like Chicago, in my state, in Hartford, Connecticut, where dozens of people are dying without the big national headlines from urban gun violence. And we're the only country in the world that looks at this rate of slaughter, which is unprecedented amongst industrialized first world countries, and throws our hands up and says we can't do anything. And so I just, I've never been more offended by anything in my life than the absolute, utter inability of Congress to even have a debate about how we might be able to do things differently. But I think it starts with gun laws. But
well, so Senator, what are those laws? I mean, when you look at, I mean, each case is obviously different, but the case yesterday, it appears that the guy, you know, he didn't have some, you know, fancy, crazy AR-15, you know, cartoon weapon. He looks like he bought it legally. What can you do to prevent that kind of violence legislatively?
Well, I mean, let's start with what the research shows us very clearly, which is that in countries and in communities that have more guns and more weapons, there is more gun violence. So in a country that hands out weapons like candy, we shouldn't be surprised that there are so many murders at the hands of guns. And so let's just be a little bit more careful about how many weapons are out on the street. Let's have states pass permit to carry laws to allow law enforcement to have a little bit more discretion in terms of who gets weapons. Let's say that maybe it's not okay for a place like Walmart to sell assault weapons. Glad that they finally decided to stop doing that, but the idea that fairly untrained people should be handing out assault weapons to anybody that comes in and passes a background check probably doesn't make sense either. So, I mean, I'd start with the premise that maybe we should be a little bit more discriminant about who gets weapons with better background checks, with better licensing laws, and that we should be a little bit more discriminant about who sells weapons. I can go into a whole litany of other things, but let's just accept that this fallacy that the NRA suggests, more guns with the good guys will stop the bad guys with the guns, actually doesn't work.
So, I mean, what about handguns? I mean, I live in the District of Columbia. It used to be illegal to own a handgun here, but courts have overturned that. I mean, a lot of this violence is just straightforwardly committed with a simple handgun, whether it's a mass shooting or a domestic violence issue. I mean, should people be allowed to carry handguns?
People should be allowed to carry handguns, but first let's admit that a lot of those people are getting them without a background check because of the degree of sales that happen online and through gun shows. And then the number of weapons that get out onto the street because they were bought at online and at gun shows. So let's have tougher gun trafficking laws and let's close background checks loopholes. And then let's have permit to carry laws. So let's actually make someone in law enforcement take a look at the individual who's purchasing the gun to make sure that they are safe to carry it. So no, I think that people should be able to buy and obtain and own handgun, but we should just be a little bit more careful about who gets it.
So you asked, after the Charleston shooting, you and your colleague from Connecticut, Senator Blumenthal, asked President Obama to issue an executive order that would close a background check loophole that had allowed Dylann Roof to actually buy a gun. Have you heard back from the president about that?
No, and I think it's a complicated question of whether the president can do it. We've asked him to. but we admit that it's much easier and clears up any muddle around the statute if Congress actually does it. Because the issue here is that if a retailer wants to, if they don't hear back from the background check system in 3 days, they can sell a gun. And that's what happened in the South Carolina shooting. So what we're saying is that retailers can make the decision themselves. I mean, why is a big national company like Cabela's or Bass Pro Shops, why on earth are they selling guns to people who haven't passed the background check? It would be an easy thing for retailers just to say, no background check, no gun. That's what Walmart actually does, and other retailers could do it too. So I'd like to pass that law. I think the president needs to take some time to figure out whether he can do it through executive action, but the industry can self-police and just close this loophole voluntarily.
You, you're pretty relentless on this issue. You talk about it almost on a daily basis, and I understand you talk about this in the well of the Senate every chance you get. I'm curious, and you don't have to name names, I guess, although if you want to, I won't stop you. I love people who name names, but what are how do your colleagues react when you talk about this? Is there just a lot of just depraved indifference, or are there people out there who are kind of like, oh, you know, I agree with you, but you know, I'm too much of a coward to do anything about it. I mean, they probably wouldn't admit to you they're a coward, but you know what I'm talking about. Are people indifferent? Are they hostile? Or are they just like, kind of like shrug, I can't help you?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think it's important to remember that we did get 55 votes for the background check bill in the Senate, so we didn't get a filibuster-proof majority, but we got a majority. Maybe we have a few less votes today. I think that there's a belief that under the current Republican leadership that we're not going to be allowed to have that debate. So I think a lot of folks are just acceptance of the status quo, given the reticence of McConnell and Boehner to bring a real debate like this to the House and Senate floor. But no, I have a lot of people who come up and pat me on the back, a lot of attaboys, more from the Democratic side than the Republican side. And you know, my hope at this point is that we can just have some debate that will help. So that's why let's do a mental health debate at least.
Sure. But do those people patting you on the back and giving you attaboys then show up and vote your way?
Yeah, I wish there were more people down there on the Senate floor actually speaking about it. And I don't quite understand why, you know, I'm the only one who goes down to the floor on a consistent basis, given the fact that it's dominating the headlines. So listen, let's admit that the NRA is more powerful than I certainly thought at the beginning of the Sandy Hook debate, and that there are a lot of Democrats who believe that the NRA stamp of approval is some proxy for their conservative or moderate Democrat credentials. And we've got to deal with that, and we've got to build up a political constituency around anti-gun violence efforts that's just as powerful as the NRA. And maybe that, when we do it, will motivate folks to come down to the floor and join me.
Well, people talk about this. They say, you know, if you can't get Congress to change the law after the Newtown shootings where children are slaughtered, then things are really hopeless unless you change the constituency or you change the representation in Congress. I mean, should the Democratic Party be supporting candidates who won't vote for tougher gun laws?
Yeah, I've never been, you know, one for a litmus test. This issue is as important as it gets to me. But, you know, as a party, I think if we actually want to control the Senate and the House, we've got to accept the Big Ten. What we have to concentrate on is building up a political movement that supports candidates that are running with pro-gun reform views. And we just didn't have that when Sandy Hook happened. And the NRA built that up over 20, 30 years, and it's going to take us maybe not that long, but it'll take us a similar amount of time. The other thing we have to remind Democrats of is that when you vote with the NRA, they don't care. They don't, right? I mean,
right.
Mark Begich voted with the NRA. He voted against the background check bill, and they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to defeat him in Alaska. So we also have to just remind Democrats that, you know, it's not like you're going to buy yourself any political favors by voting with the NRA. They want Republicans, period, stop. Even they don't want Democrats who are with them. They just want Republicans in charge of every seat.
That makes a lot of sense. All right, Senator, we got to leave it there. Maybe the next time we have you on the podcast, we'll be talking about something a little brighter, a little happier. But thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for focusing on this, guys. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. All right, we'll be right back. Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program. Hey, everybody, we're back. Joining me now, very pleasure, we have the Huffington Post immigration reporter and the internet's own Elise Foley is here.
How's it going?
It's going great. It's going great. It's very nice to have you back on the podcast. And also joining us by phone, we have Julio Ricardo Varela. He is the digital media director of NPR's Latino USA and the founder of LatinoRebels.com. Julio, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So, what a week for the world of 2016 and the Latino vote. We had the Republican Party's leading candidate once again go to extravagant lengths to keep Republicans from ever winning the Latino vote. What is going on in this world?
That's such a good question. I mean, 2012 was not that long ago. And do you remember, like, immediately after the election, like, the next day, you had all these Republicans coming out and being like, we self-deportation was such a mistake for Romney to say that. And now you have people saying so much worse things. I mean, self-deportation sounds almost nice compared to the idea of deporting a bunch of, like, U.S. citizen children.
It's seriously crazy. The Republicans put out a 100-page document called the Growth and Opportunity Report, which I think we all call the RNC autopsy. And it wasn't necessarily on every single page of this document, but at least I'd say 65 pages. It was just like, and by the way, we need to win the Latino vote. Why do we keep alienating Latinos? So, Julio, why do you think the Republicans keep alienating you?
Well, you know what? why am I alienated?
You personally.
Yeah, right. But, you know, one of the things, and I know the fabulous Elise Foley would agree with me because she's covered many of the things that I've covered. This has kind of been percolating, right? Let's remember, what Donald Trump has done is tapped into sort of this feeling of the country's getting invaded by a horde of Mexicans, and we need to do something about this ASAP, you know. And remember last year in Murrieta and in other places during the Central American migrant crisis, and there was this, it was just really, really ugly. So that is the voter. And the strategy by the Trump campaign is basically saying that we're not really going to worry about the Latino vote. We rather want to pit GOP voters against Latinos, against immigrants, so that we're the ones that are telling you, hey, you lost that job, or hey, you're not making as much money, or the middle class is suffering. Guess who's to blame? It's that horde of, you know, invading Mexicans crossing the border. And that's resonating. That's the scary thing about all this, is that that message, which has been percolating for years, is, you know, Trump has almost enabled it.
You know, this is a question I've always kind of wanted to ask, and I want to get you guys' opinion on it. When we talk about the Latino vote writ large, we're also talking about American citizens and legal immigrants. So what is it about this community that when you call out one section of them, everyone sort of sees themselves as part of that criticism? You know, that's always fascinated me, because white people are really good at just giving other white people the Heisman when they, you know, like, it would be no big deal for me to be like, yeah, fuck those white people. But it seems to me that, like, one kind of, like, if you wound one part of the Latino community, everyone sort of is wounded by it.
I mean, I'm not a Latina, so I can't speak to it necessarily on a personal level.
Elise, you're an adopted Latina.
I appreciate that. But there's been polling that shows that within the Latino community, and with Latino voters, they're much more likely to know somebody who's undocumented than, you know, your average white person would be. So that means that when people say this stuff, they are talking about maybe your neighbor or someone you know, somebody in your family, and it's just a lot more personal. I think the other thing is that the tone of it and the rhetoric is often not just anti-undocumented immigrant, but kind of anti-immigrant in general. People coming to take our jobs, they're not just talking about undocumented people. They're talking about legal immigrants as well. And there are all these instances of yelling, "Go back to Mexico," at people who are U.S. citizens, whether they were born here or not. So I think it just becomes this much, much broader thing that's more personal than, you know, just talking about undocumented people.
Right. It's one of the things is this notion of foreignness. And I think it's not only about the personal. I mean, you can look at the stats. You can look at Pew saying that, you know, people do have connections. But it goes beyond that. And I agree with Elise in this capacity, in the sense that there's this growing fear of, you know, I call it fear of a brown planet, to sort of like paraphrase one of my favorite Public Enemy albums, because I always do that. It's this sense that anyone from, like, this foreignness, this changing of America, this browning of America, and this, you know, the fact that when you say that the United States will be the second largest Spanish-speaking country in the world by 2050, like, that freaks people out. Because it's, you know, history has shown that America has changed, and, you know, we've survived, and the United States is now going into the next phase that is more Latin American, that is going to be more multicultural, that's going to be more diverse, and there's this sort of, you know, bizarre irony that, you know, the previous immigrants are now, you know, casting dispersions on the new immigrants. Now, I am Puerto Rican, right? And people always say, well, you shouldn't care about immigration. You're a U.S. citizen. You guys are born there. I'm like, yeah, but it's almost like by luck. Right? You know, we got invaded by the United States in 1898. And next thing you know, like, they needed us in World War I and we became U.S. citizens. You know, so and you look at the advocates of immigration and you see people like Luis Gutierrez, who's Puerto Rican, who has a Mexican constituency in Chicago. And the reality is, it's like there's this common bond, whether it's cultural, whether it's linguistic, whether it's a shared history. And the Latino community in the United States is trying to figure that out now. And that's where the Ramos thing comes in, because there's not a lot of voices out there that are saying to Trump or someone of the stature of Jorge Ramos saying, hey, I don't agree with you, or I want to challenge you.
I want to talk a bit about the whole Jorge Ramos incident, because I watched it happen on TV, and it was like one of those things that happens when you're watching it. It's so absurd and controversial and weird that it's almost like the world starts to tilt on its axis. I hadn't felt about seeing something on TV like Donald Trump throwing Jorge Ramos, who's like Univision superstar. He's like a journalist / matinee idol, practically one of the most famous journalists in the world, certainly the most famous Latino journalist in America. To me, it was like watching Mike Tyson bite that dude's ear. Like, I was just like, wait, what is happening? Am I in a
what
nightmare?
An analogy. Like,
wow. It's like Public Enemy, Mike Tyson. I mean, I love this show already.
Tell your friends. So what on earth was Donald Trump thinking in that moment?
The thing is, I don't know, but I think he was annoyed and he doesn't care. But I just don't know that it's going to hurt him any more than he's already been hurt with Latino voters. I mean, he clearly doesn't care. My favorite thing about it was just him, you know, going on and on about how he was just being a protector of decorum and politeness, as if Donald Trump doesn't love to scream at people and say things that aren't PC. But yeah, I mean, it's not, I just wonder whether it would even hurt him. He's so bad off with Latinos anyway.
Right. As a journalist, I mean, one of the things, you know, obviously we shared it on Latino USA, my boss, Maria Hinojosa, you know, she's been talking about it, and we've been talking about it internally. But, you know, so we've gotten all the tweets to us saying, well, you know, he broke the rules, or, you know, he's an activist journalist, or, but if you break down that tape before the ear bite, He was, you know, they said that he spoke out of turn, but, like, you know, I've watched the tape 10 times or 15 times, and he was actually asking the question, and Trump was completely like, you're not even going there, buddy.
I mean, and if you've been to a press conference, people talk out of turn all the time. It's a lot of times the only way to get your question in.
This is clearly now a division of, you know, you're either with Trump or you're with Ramos. And I hate to, like, simplify it, but even someone like Jorge Ramos, who is, again, an amazing Latino journalist, he's, you know, the most recognizable cover of Time, but he's, you know, he's like any other journalist. Not everyone thinks that Jorge Ramos is this amazing Mexican journalist, but this conference has sort of, he's become sort of the voice to stand up to Donald Trump. What really sort of put the, you know, sealed the deal with a lot of people wasn't actually him getting kicked out. It was that Trump supporter outside in the hall telling him to go back to his country. Like, that's the one where I have Latino Republican friends who are like, you know what? I don't agree with Ramos. He's not my favorite journalist, but come on. It was more that video where the guy said, go back to your country. And when he said, you know what? This is my country. The guy backed off and he's like, well, that's what I mean. It's like this fear of change, of what are you losing? What are you really losing? And, you know, Jose Diaz-Balart, who's the Telemundo anchor and is on MSNBC, he said it best on Meet the Press, and he goes, the world, it's already changed, guys.
We keep reading about how establishment Republicans are horrified by what Donald Trump is doing because they don't necessarily believe he'll be the nominee, but they believe that, like, every time he opens his mouth, he does something to undermine the person who will be the eventual nominee. I wanted to ask you guys, what do you think about that? Is there any truth to that?
I mean, I think it's going to last to a certain degree. The fact that he's out there saying certain things means that other Republicans get asked things that maybe they wouldn't otherwise be asked. Maybe that's their position, but they wouldn't be out there talking about it, and that would hurt them. There was this Gallup poll that came out this week, their general tracking, that found that Jeb Bush still had a net favorable with Latinos. So that polling, you know, kind of indicates that just because Trump is out there saying bad things doesn't mean that it's reflecting on every single Republican candidate, but I mean, the ads are so easy there to put up that, you know, this is who this party is, even if it's not the nominee.
Right. I mean, I think the damage has been done. I think when Elise mentioned, you know, self-deportation sounds a lot more favorable. And that 27% number that Mitt Romney got in 2012, which led to the memo, you know, where you put Latino every other page for the RNC. I think right now the Republican Party, if they get 27% of the vote of the Latino vote in 2016, that's going to be a victory.
Wow!
Right now, but I do think there's going to be a lot of damage. But here's the thing: Jeb Bush has had to play the Trump. You know, has had to play in Trump's world the last couple of weeks with the anchor baby comment and then comparing it to the Asians.
Oh, yeah, that was crazy.
You know, and it's like you're not even doing it right. I mean, if I was running Bush's campaign right now, I'd be like, you know, you might have to get down to Trump's level and say, like, you know what, buddy? Suck it. I'm a better candidate, and let's get it on. You're a loser, too. And I do think that Republican candidate who says, you know what, I'm done because this guy's putting too much damage – and he doesn't represent what Republicans represent. And there's a lot of Republicans I know who are just appalled and just say, like, I'm done. I'm going to fight this guy, and it's over. And Bush, I mean, Bush is the guy. And the other one is Rubio. I mean, the guy sounded really sensible at the debate, like, three, 4 weeks ago when it came to immigration. And he's just disappeared. So,
yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. Someone's got to show up and be the alpha, I guess. All right. Thank you so much, Julio, for joining us. Before you go, tell everyone your Twitter handle.
Oh, my Twitter handle is, I can't change it. It's Julito77, J-U-L-I-T-O 77, the number 7, 77.
And Elise, you are at?
At Elise Foley.
All right.
Pretty easy.
Thanks to both of you, and we will be right back.
And we're back. In keeping with just what a terrible news week this is, we have something really terrible to talk about today, and it is the destruction of ancient ruins in a really cool place called Palmyra by ISIS, who suck. Joining me here to talk about it are two wonderful people, Allie Watkins.
Thanks for having me.
And Akbar Ahmed. Akbar.
Thanks for having us.
Akbar, have you been on before?
I have been on once.
So, yeah. Okay, so this is not your maiden voyage on the podcast. So, Akbar, let's start with you, Akbar. I mean, so what is the new terrible thing that ISIS, we learned, has done?
Sure. So ISIS went into Palmyra and the adjoining town of Tadmor about 6 or 7 weeks ago. And the big thing they did this week is that they destroyed the Temple of Baal Shanin. That's a temple that is 2,000 years old. It was the Phoenician temple to the god of storms and rain. And it's been around for a long time, a lot longer than ISIS. The importance of this is that Palmyra is a city, right? It's not just one or two monuments. This is one of the biggest things. There are four or five parts of Palmyra that people say are the key to it. And this is one of the things they did. They released a video of it on Tuesday, and people have been talking about it. It's a little terrifying because the question is, where do they go from here? This comes on the heels of their killing the director of antiquities of Palmyra last week.
Yeah.
They didn't think that was enough.
Khalid al-Assad, who is an old guy, too. He's in, like, his 80s.
Like, 82 or 83. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of theories about why they would do this after they killed Assad. One of them is ISIS craves attention, right? They want people to see what they're doing and think, oh, my God, you are so terrible, I'm terrified. And the media did a pretty smart thing when they were covering Assad's murder. They didn't make it about, oh, this is so tragic. They made it a story of heroism. Like, this director of antiquities stayed in Palmyra, refused to take ISIS to the ruins.
And he refused to leave. I mean, he was offered the opportunity to leave, and he refused. So
it wasn't a story of, like, ISIS is sowing despair. It was a story of kind of human survival and resistance to ISIS.
And a lot of the stuff in Palmyra has been smuggled out, essentially. So there are a lot of antiquities that made it to other places, that, you know, like the British Museum is trying to deal with it at different places. Other places in Syria, in Damascus, they're trying to deal with them. They're in secret locations. So it's not like the whole thing has been gone. But like you were saying, Akbar, I mean, Palmyra is such an interesting place. It's such an interesting historical place. It's sort of halfway between the Mediterranean and the Euphrates River. So for shipping in the ancient world, you kind of have to go through Palmyra if you want to take a land route to a direct land route to the Euphrates. So all of these different interesting empires have been there.
Right.
I was really struck, you know, the temple, you know, in a lot of Greek writing, that god Baal Shanin is sometimes identified with Zeus in some types of writing. It shows the sort of interesting pluralism that existed in the ancient world. And I can see why that would be something that ISIS would find repugnant, but also something that you know, it's... I was almost more upset by the destruction of the temple than I have been by the videos of people getting their heads cut off. I mean, Ali, am I a monster for feeling that way?
No, I think that they're two different, very different kind of travesties that kind of hit at different, pull at different strings of humanity as far as what happens. I mean, you have this terrible, you see these terrible things being done to fellow human beings, but the actual attempts to erase history, you know, this complete inability to accept any other existence besides the ISIS manifesto, essentially, is this need to erase everything out. That, I think, it really hits at innate fear of every human, of having your entire history erased, you know? Obviously, none of us were worshiping in that temple, but it's a
living ruin.
Yeah.
I think that's the really important part of it. In terms of, I had a friend who was there a few years ago before the Syrian civil war broke out. And I asked him last night about what were your memories, what were your recollections? And he said, obviously the ruins are so imposing, they're incredible, you think about history, but you also think about the fact that there are Syrians living adjoining these ruins. Like, this was not a pluralistic society 2,000 years ago, this was a pluralistic society last year,
right?
Syria is a plural country. Syria has Christians, Assyrians, Kurds, lots of people who were living together fine before ISIS went in. And I think on this question of, like, are you a monster? You may be a monster for other reasons. however, on this count, I don't think you're necessarily a monster. There was a beautiful piece in The Guardian about why should we care about this, right? In a world where ISIS kills people in Iraq, kills people in Syria every day. And we care about this because it's saying that, like, humanity is more than biological creatures, right? It's not just like lives you kill, it's also what humanity constructs and lives on. And like, this attacks a part of our lives, a part of our culture that that exist beyond just beings.
Right, that the culture and identity are things that exist independently of these independent right. individual units that walk around. You have to live in a sort of cultural soup to be an individual even.
Right.
And to see not only the culture, like history, die out, but have it be erased.
And
or
I
attempted
think
to be erased.
Yeah, the heaviness of this is just exacerbated, I think, from a Western perspective, particularly from an American perspective, of that the concept of something being from the first century is something almost completely lost on us. You know, like, history to us is 300 years, and that's all
right.
shit, you know.
Right.
But you look at Palmyra, and it's just this, you realize what it means and what it represents and the developments that have happened, and these things are still standing. So, I really think it hits at different parts of the human condition. And
so in the spirit of sticking it to ISIS, I want to encourage all of our listeners to go out and study. There's just one figure from Palmyran history, who is, I think she's the most famous one. She's so cool. I'm always like kind of surprised that that Shakespeare never did a Zenobia like tragedy. It's such an awesome character. You should check her out. She led a revolt against the Roman Empire in the 3rd century. People forget the Roman Empire. Like, the richest parts of the Roman Empire were like Syria, Egypt, Mesopotamia. Like, the right. West was not very wealthy. She led a revolt that was successful. She conquered the province of Egypt, which was a Roman province, and then in the end ends up being sort of defeated and taken to Rome in chains. It's an amazing story. She's a really interesting figure. People should check her out. Don't let ISIS win. Before we go, Ali, what is the United States doing right now to make sure that ISIS doesn't win? How is that going?
Well, there was a piece yesterday, which I think is the U.S. doesn't know, because there are these really interesting revelations about intelligence analysts being forced to essentially lie about how well the fight is going.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's no secret that the strategy to combat ISIS has been very piecemeal over the last, we've been a year into this now, right. roughly a year.
And the U.S. is focused as Iraq, not Syria.
Mm-hmm.
I would say on the Syria piece, though, what I think is really important for people to remember about this, is that the Assad regime, the dictator who rules Syria, have been the folks who are making the most noise about Palmyra. In their view, this is how they say, we are not ISIS, we are the people who will protect Palmyra, protect Syria's history.
Mm-hmm.
Don't believe that. It's a lie. The Assad regime has been bombing the citadel of Aleppo, they have bombed the suburbs of Damascus, they don't care about Syrian history. And I think that is like something we need to remember with the ISIS fight. These people are terrible, but the American involvement there needs to be smart about who it works with if it cares about things like Palmyra.
All right, so we got to wrap. Thanks for joining us. Akbar, where can people find you on the Twitters?
Akbar S. Ahmed. Don't look up other Akbar Ahmed, because he is not me. I'm me. I'm Akbar Shahid Ahmed.
With an S in there.
With an S in there.
And Ali?
Ali Watkins, just at Ali Watkins.
All right, great. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
I guess thank you guys for joining. We'll thank the listeners for listening at the end of the podcast, which maybe this is, maybe it's not. We'll find out.
And through the force of editing, we are back.
Amazing.
Let the force be with us.
That was pretty amazing. So sort of like, this is sort of, I guess, a 2016 story, but we're going to get a little nostalgic, okay? This week, it was reported Joe Biden, Vice President, Uncle Joe, thinking about maybe running for president, and as part of, I guess, now the new ritual of Democrats running for president, he made a sort of like pilgrimage to meet with Senator Elizabeth Warren. What they spoke about, we do not know, because we were not privy to those things. If anyone wants to leak what the fuck they talked about, of course, we'll take it.
Yeah. Email. So that happened at HuffingtonPost.com. Leak us things.
Just leak us all your shit. Do it today. One of the things that our wonderful producer, Adriana Usero, caught during the midweek was a little bit of Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren's past history. We go back to 2005, set the stage. 2005, remember, this is prior to big economic meltdown. And there's a debate in Congress over whether or not to pass a bankruptcy law that would, in the eyes of the people promoting this, reform bankruptcy law.
Yeah, and that law basically had the effect of preventing people from accessing bankruptcy.
Well, it's a law that Republicans and some Democrats in Congress have been pushing for almost 10 years by that time.
Yeah.
And George W. Bush and his administration was pushing for it, and everyone agreed that bankruptcy was being abused. You
know, too many people were filing.
People were incurring credit card debt they couldn't pay and then just getting out of paying their debt by going into bankruptcy.
But there was this one dissenting voice in the sort of establishment bankruptcy culture, and it was this Harvard professor named Elizabeth Warren, who at that point nobody in the political universe had really thought about very much.
At this point, she was probably just riding the wave of her personal finance book and her professorship.
Yeah, she was just an academic who had been studying bankruptcy and found surprisingly that actually the people who file for bankruptcy aren't all these deadbeats who are just buying like 7 gold-plated TVs and stuff. They're people who have a medical emergency that costs a lot of money. They're people who get divorced, or they're people who lose a job. I mean, that was basically why people were filing.
But
for
especially
bankruptcy.
The medical debt, which I think was a factor in a majority of bankruptcy cases.
Yeah, yes. Let's also remember this is the time prior to Obamacare.
We're going to play a clip.
Yeah, we're going to play a little bit of a clip.
Joe Biden, the senator from Delaware, facing off against the expert witness on this committee, Elizabeth Warren.
It's the question of what role bankruptcy plays.
So that's not my question. I'd like you to answer my question. What role is there under what you would consider to be an appropriate form of government, where we legislate? Do we say that people who in good faith provide a service for an individual, that the individual is unable to meet because of a legitimately horrific and extraordinary dilemma that was an act of God, that who should be responsible for taking them out from under? Should it be the automobile company who lent the money to purchase a car, the drugstore that lent them money, that provided a service, in effect lent the money because there's a bill for the drug bill, the utility company, the guy who has the lawn service company? I mean, whose responsibility is it? Because that's really the question.
Senator, I think you're exactly right. And that is that we need fewer families to need to turn to the bankruptcy system. We have a broken healthcare finance system in the United States.
Right.
And all I can do is point out that it is bankrupting families.
Absolutely right.
Until we fix the broken healthcare finance system,
right,
those families have to turn somewhere. And that means now they turn as a last-ditch effort to the bankruptcy court.
And that means they turn to asking the people that they borrowed money from to pay for their healthcare cost, right?
Senator, the cost...
Isn't that literally correct?
It is literally correct.
Thank
that you. The cost of a broken healthcare system are born throughout the economy.
We are asking, and I may be ready to do this. We're going to ask the gas company, the drugstore, the automobile dealer to pay for the broken system instead of having the nerve to come and say it's a moral obligation of a nation to pay for that broken system. Why should it be someone who sits there living in a $2 million home for whom it lent no money to that person? Why do they not have an obligation to pay for that instead of the guy who owns the drugstore at the corner pay for that? That's my only point. And it may make sense. And I might add for the record, I'd like to put in the record a Forbes article, and I'd like to ask you whether it's an accurate quote, Professor. They quote you in an article entitled "Everybody Knows It's Credit" in Forbes magazine, saying, quote, "The lobbyists are going to be the only ones who really profit," scoffs Elizabeth Warren, Harvard law professor. I think you're dead right, because it points out in here, as you point out, we may have to find new boogeymen. The one people who aren't going to benefit out of this are the credit card companies, as you point out in here. I submit this to the for the record, but I just think we should be honest about this thing. And you know, we're making a gas company, which I don't like the gas company. I don't like many companies, but anyway, pay is we just ought to acknowledge what we're doing here when we make these kind of assertions.
Thank you, Senator Biden. Can Professor Warren just respond to the quote?
I think the senator makes an entirely fair point about externalizing the cost, and I would add only one caveat to it. Not only does this bill treat all debtors alike, in many ways it treats all creditors alike, the gas company doesn't have the capacity to change its pricing to reflect these risks, or has very limited capacity. But I remind you of what the credit card companies
Should the gas company be required to change the prices to reflect these?
Of course they do, Senator.
Well, the way you stated it, you said they don't have the capacity. The implication is maybe they should have it.
No, my point is the losses will go to some creditors who cannot reflect this in their prices. But look at the cases cited in my testimony, where credit card companies, I have a specific case in Ray McCarthy, but nothing unusual about it. A woman who borrowed $2,200, the credit she paid back $2,100 over the 2 years preceding bankruptcy. And at the end of that period of time, she was told she still owed $2,600. With fees and interest, I submit, Senator, that there are many in the credit industry right now who are getting their bankruptcies prepaid. That is, they have squeezed enough out of these families in interest and fees and payments that never
take down. Maybe we should talk about usury rates then. Maybe that's what
Senator,
we should be talking about, not bankruptcy.
I'll be the first. Invite me.
No, I know you will, but let's call a spade a spade. Your problem with the credit card companies is usury rates from your position. It's not about the bankruptcy bill.
But, Senator, if you're not going to fix that problem, you can't take away the last shred of protection for
your
family.
I got it. Okay. You're very good, Professor.
That is so intense. I hear that, and it's amazing that people are talking about this Joe Biden candidacy, and they're like, Joe Biden's going to be the guy who's going to talk like honestly about income inequality, unlike that phony Hillary Clinton who's got all that money and the Clinton Foundation stuff. And I'm like, it's hard for me to remember to think of that, because when I was a banking reporter before I worked for Huffington Post,
right. He
was the senator. He was like the joke about him was that Joe Biden was the senator from MBNA, which
right. Was
a credit card company.
Because
now it's just part of Bank of America.
Many credit card companies were. And still are headquartered in the state of Delaware
because of
the way its taxes work and all that.
I have to say that it is so extraordinary to me to listen to that, because when I heard the whole clip, and we'll put the whole clip hopefully in our article somehow. When I listened to the whole clip, at first I'm listening to Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren go back and forth. I don't see why they're arguing. They both seem to be talking about the same thing. But as it sort of reveals itself, Joe Biden is taking this luxury of being able to talk about bankruptcy in abstract terms. He brings Warren on because he wants to know, philosophically speaking, who should bear the responsibility when someone fails in this capacity and files bankruptcy.
Right.
Should it be the government? Should it be a creditor? Who should play this off? And what Warren wants to talk about is the practical aspect of it, which is that we have a healthcare system at the time, circa 2005. We have a healthcare system where a lot of people are incurring bankruptcy just as a product of them getting sick and not being able to afford to pay it, and then losing everything and needing this harbor to even get back on their feet financially after the fact. And what Biden wants to talk about, there's a point where he says, you know, you're concerned with the usury rates on credit cards
right.
and things like that. And she's like, of course I'm concerned about that. But really what I'm concerned about is that before we fix these things, you need to make sure that there is that cushion, that harbor.
Well, here's what Joe Biden is doing in this clip. Elizabeth Warren has been out there making a straightforward argument that the bankruptcy reform that they've proposed and are about to pass is a straightforward giveaway to credit card companies and banks. And she's also noted that these bankruptcy users aren't people who've just bought a bunch of TVs. They have medical debt. So what Joe Biden's saying is, and he's doing it in as confusing a way as possible, because he needs to sow confusion right now.
Yeah, I mean, basically, Biden is trying to misdirect the audience. He's trying to tell people, look, Elizabeth Warren is talking about a different problem, and I'm trying to talk about this other thing that is important, when actually what she's saying is, yes, so since you're not going to fix all these other things, which you've just acknowledged you're not going to fix, if you're going to push somebody out of a window with medical debt, it doesn't make sense to pull the mattress out from under the building with the bankruptcy code, with this bill, which is what they're doing.
All right, but let me ask you this. Okay, let's remember, is 2005. This is 3 years before Bear Stearns collapses, 3 years before Lehman Brothers collapses. And this is a time when everyone kind of thought the good times may sometimes take a little bit of a stagger, but they really weren't going to end. The financial services sector thought they had slain the beast of risk, and it was never they were never going to worry about risk ever again.
We had credit default swaps to solve all of our problems.
Exactly. Like, there were dilapidated houses in my own city that were selling for seven figures, and everyone thought, oh, that they're, I'm sure that makes sense to somebody, so let's not question it.
Let's be clear, not everyone thought that, but that was the public face.
That was literally 10 years ago. Surely, maybe the what the Democrats have to prove is who's learned the most in 10 years about the way the world really works. You know, Joe Biden was off on some kind of really undergraduate economics 101 jag with Elizabeth Warren and ended up getting schooled not just by her, but by reality down the line. So now, who do you think? Do you think Joe Biden's learned nothing?
I mean, the question is whether he can separate his politics from the politics of the country from the politics of Delaware. So when you represent Delaware, these people who represent that state are always shilling for not just credit card companies, but all who now are basically the biggest banks in the country. It's funny, this fantasy world 10 years ago when there were like these credit card companies and they weren't the same thing as too big to fail banks. They were independent groups. And now they're all just
that was different.
Banks.
Yeah.
So there's a sense in which the world has gotten worse.
I'm sure that Joe Biden still thinks that Delaware is a place where like blue collar workers go to work at DuPont. Blah blah blah.
But these companies really are having huge offices in Wilmington, and you can see these gleaming towers. And so the argument is simple. I think if you're forced to make it, and you're a guy like Joe Biden, I was defending jobs in my state. But it's kind of a wonky issue. But that's what senators historically have done. It's a totally parochial interest. Yep. You got me that time.
So he may be able to separate that out in the White House, I think he's in the executive branch, like some of his economic advisors have been the most progressive members of the Obama economic team, who subsequently got ignored. But like what, you know, Arthur, you cover like a lot of poverty stuff for us. I mean, you're kind of our sadness correspondent. I mean, what were the effects of this bankruptcy bill when it passed? Like happened?
Well, it was straight up supposed to, they presumed people were abusing bankruptcy, so they wanted fewer people to do it. It had been about 1.5 million bankruptcy cases a year, and then after the law passed, that cratered to less than 1 million, about 600,000 in the first year afterward. And the argument was, well, we'll have fewer bankruptcy, but because the credit cards will be saving money, they will pass on that savings to consumers in the form of, you know, lower fees, lower interest rates. And it just didn't happen. and there wasn't really a good reason to believe that that would happen, because there isn't a tremendous amount of competition in that industry, and there's been even less since then. But studies have been done, and you can see that interest rates continue to rise, fees continue to rise, and the savings for consumers turn out to be mythical. But the restriction on bankruptcy and all the different ways that it was made less generous, those worked.
I want to explain to people who don't maybe follow this stuff so closely what bankruptcy actually does. I mean, it just seems like it's like the end of the world for a lot of people. It's like financially they were ruined.
It's actually the safety net.
Yeah, it's a way for you, if you have too much debt that you're never going to be able to repay, you can go to bankruptcy court and get that debt discharged. And there will be, or if not totally discharged, you can have it reduced in certain ways. And there's a judge who oversees the process to make sure that certain creditors don't get the short end of the stick unfairly and things like that. It's a way to start over. And there are significant penalties you incur for that. Your credit is ruined.
Yeah.
You know, you're not gonna
for
be able
a period
to,
of yeah, time.
You're not going to be able to get a house for a few years, you know. And so
sure, I'm not going to get a loan.
Right. But it's a way to start over. And it's always been part of economic systems going back to, you know, the fucking third century AD.
Oh, is that no. Or in this country's early history, instead of bankruptcy, we just put debtors in prison.
Right.
And now, increasingly, we do that through things like court fees and, in Ferguson, Missouri, for instance, you fail to pay a fee for not mowing your lawn, you get thrown in jail. We have effectively still got bankruptcy.
Debtors'
prisons, but there was a time where they were actually called that, and we just threw people who owed money straight in jail, and states stopped doing that like 200 years ago.
There's also this funny effect of that law that because you couldn't get, as you had fewer bankruptcies, people couldn't get their stuff discharged. if you, it used to be if you owned a house, for instance, and you had equity in the house, then, you know, if you got this other stuff discharged, they'd let you keep your house. You can't get mortgage debt discharged in bankruptcy, so that's not going to go away. But what happened is when the financial crisis hit and the economy fell apart, when people couldn't discharge their debts in bankruptcy, you saw this enormous wave of foreclosures because people couldn't deal with other bills. They couldn't make their other bills lower, and that meant they couldn't make their housing payments. And that actually made the crisis even worse than it needed to be.
And
was another effort to change bankruptcy law as the crisis was at its peak, which was to allow home values to be reduced in bankruptcy court. Mm-hmm. It was called cram down.
Yeah,
and I remember that.
Right, and this is another arena where Elizabeth Warren was saying, "Yeah, do that," and the Obama administration was like, "Eh." Yeah. They didn't come out against it, but they effectively prevented it from happening.
I mean, when the bailout actually happened in 2008, before Obama was president, he went around telling Democrats, "Please vote for this bill. If you vote for this when I'm president, I'll do the mortgage cram down bill to fight foreclosures." And then they did it. He became president, then he was pretty meh on the foreclosure stuff.
So I have to ask you something, because part of my duty on the show is to constantly be fomenting the class war.
fight capital.
full communism. you talk about how this bankruptcy bill had an effect on people and that people were no longer able to discharge their debts. I've been told that corporations are people, my friend. So did the bankruptcy – we would change bankruptcy law. Certainly it impacted corporations just as adversely as it did normal people.
No, we're only talking about personal bankruptcy.
Wait, what?
Some provisions did affect small businesses, but not big ones.
It actually kind of made it worse for small businesses.
Yeah, it did. It did. but big businesses – I mean, this has been Donald Trump's and Newt Gingrich's way of escaping all kinds of – burdensome debts.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren, in her testimony in the 2005 case, she actually lists all of these, like Enron, WorldCom, all these people who are not affected, who like clearly abuse the bankruptcy process, and she's like, WTF?
It's almost
a clear double standard that remains.
It's almost as if people who have a lot of money can pay for lobbyists to change laws in their favor, through which they garner more income, through which they purchase more lobbyists.
I mean, the senators who voted yes for this bill overwhelmingly had more money in contributions to their campaigns.
Of course.
The finance industry. So there's a nice correlation there.
Oh, well.
So, and just to be clear, so we're not too hard on Joe Biden here. Hillary Clinton voted for versions of this bill.
Correct.
In the past.
Everybody did. Yeah, it was 75 yay votes. Barack Obama was a no.
Yep.
But this was very mainstream.
How did Bernie Sanders vote on it?
I'm pretty sure Bernie Sanders voted against it.
And Martin O'Malley was probably just like telling Baltimore police to be assholes at the time. Didn't have anything to do with this in particular.
I don't know where he was in 2005. He was filming for The Wire. Well, that was fun, guys. Hope we don't go bankrupt.
Bye.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Adriana Ucero, with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, Latino USA Digital Media Director and founder of Latino Rebels, Julio Ricardo Varela, and Huffington Post reporters Akbar Ahmed, Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Elise Foley, and Allie Watkins. So That Happened is available on iTunes. Check us out in the iTunes store and look for the Huffington Post whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, thanks for listening, and we miss you already.
Catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.